We are now audio recording, and just a reminder to all, I am going to mute all, and people do have the ability to unmute themselves if they want to chime in, either by voice or using the chat window. We'll monitor that, and with that, we will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck, and welcome all.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. As usual, we have quite a mixed bag of things, so here we go. And the first thing is a share by Chris.
Yeah, this I just happened to come across this. New York Times, I get their headlines sent to me every day, and they also send out this thing, an occasional thing, of just more in-depth articles. And they had this one on scam calls, and one of the quotes from the headlines was, "Every year, tens of millions of Americans collectively lose billions of dollars to scam callers. Where does the other end of the line lead?" Now, I think we've all run into these scam calls where they call and say that they're, you know, calling from Microsoft or, you know, tech support, and they want to fix a problem that you've got or whatever. And they want to basically get remote control of your computer, and then they can do whatever they want. So it was mildly interesting the way they went through that part. But what was more interesting was when they actually had some of the reporters actually go to places like Thailand and whatever, wherever these were coming from, and they actually did some interviews with some of the actual scammers and so forth, and they talked a little bit more in depth about the difficulties that there are in getting these things shut down when you're talking about international borders and countries that don't necessarily want to or care as much about enforcing laws and so forth. So the URL is on the screen there. I will paste that into the chat window as well if you're interested in reading it. I found it to be an interesting article.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And our next item is a follow-up from the discussion we had last week on how to convert various movie file formats. And Stuart came up with a couple. We talked a little bit about VLC, and that does in fact do video conversion. But he's got a link here for a guide, a how-to guide, so that could be quite useful, I guess. And he also says he's used a program called Make MKV. And I'm sure Chris will put the URLs for those two.
Yeah, I will be pasting them down.
And then a couple of others. Dan suggested Any Video Converter Free, which sounds like it's free. And it will convert any video, I guess. So that should be a good one. And Tom suggests Handbrake, which is a program from France which he uses to convert videos from DVD. So if you're interested in converting movie files from different formats to other formats, then there's a whole bunch of suggestions for you. Okay, moving along, another follow-up. This is by Bob, following up on his presentation last week on BookBub. So I call this BookBub Plus. So over to you, Bob.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to cover just a few more e-reading resources here. Next slide. When we covered BookBub, I really focused on their daily email service, which gives you the ebook deals of the day. And you can get some pretty good ebooks there, anywhere from free up to about $2, $3, and occasionally $4 or $5, which is a nice big discount and whatever. However, BookBub bills themselves as a book discovery site. And if you're just looking for new ebooks to read in any category or whatever, you can go anytime to BookBub site and search by category, author, or some other criteria and to find some new ebooks to read. And the pricing of any of the ebooks you find on BookBub is quite often better than at the other sites like Amazon and Kobo, even though BookBub links you to those sites to do the actual purchase of the ebooks. So that's a big advantage. Next. Next, yeah. Another great site to go to if you're interested in something good to read is Goodreads. And it's arguably the best leading online community for book lovers. And it's one of the leading online review and recommendation sites. As well as editorial reviews and recommendations, there's lots and lots of actual reader reviews and recommendations. And that can be important because I'm sure we've all, you know, seen reviewers rate a book or a movie really, really good. And then when you check it out yourself, it just sucks, or the other way around. And because Goodreads has a whole lot of actual reader reviews and reader recommendations, that tends to level the playing field. So if some reviewer gives the book 5 out of 5, but the average score over 500 readers is 3 out of 5, you might want to look a little bit further. They have other online resources like online sessions with popular authors, blogs, recommendation lists, and all sorts of stuff. Now, I haven't done a real deep dive into this site, but I tend to use it mostly for going after reviews and recommendations, but a whole lot of stuff there. And like BookBub, you can buy the ebooks through links to the various retailers. And again, the prices through Goodreads is quite often better than going directly to the retailer site.
Bob, Greg's asking if these websites are more focused on novels.
They tend to be focused on all sorts of different books. BookBub, for example, has, I think it's 44 different categories. And they're not even drilled down. Like for example, on my daily email from BookBub, quite often I get cookbooks, and I'm interested in cooking. And if you can get a cookbook for a couple bucks, as opposed to paying $40 or $50 for a paper copy, and then finding out there's only one good recipe in there that's worth a damn, it makes a difference. So they have a lot of stuff. Now, Amazon isn't the best site to go to if you're just looking for something new to read in any particular category. But if you search there for a book you've heard about from somewhere else, they have a lot of editorial reviews, customer reviews, and the real big thing is sampling. In a lot of cases, you can actually flip through some pages of the book. So, again, getting back to cookbooks, you can flip through the table of contents, and if there's no recipes in there that look particularly interesting, you don't need to bother buying the book. But if there's 3 or 4 recipes that look great, fine. And same goes for a lot of other books. That flip through can be very valuable. Okay, next. Yeah, another great source for e-books is the Ottawa Public Library. They offer ebooks, digital newspapers, digital magazines, and all sorts of other stuff online. They have a collection of popular fiction and nonfiction ebooks that are usually available on a 7-day loan period. So you download it, and 7 days later they go poof and they're gone off your computer or reader. But it's a great way to get some very current bestsellers for free and get a chance to read them. Now, you have to be an Ottawa resident to get a library card and access these resources. I know for actual books, they have agreements with other local libraries in Gatineau and all that to share books back and forth, but I don't believe they have that for e-books.
Baba, I think the 7-day loan period is for express books. I think normally, the e-books I normally get are for 21 days.
21 days? I took this information right off their site, so.
Okay.
Well, not a lot of detail.
You can set it for 7 or 14 days when you take out an e-book or an audio book that's downloadable.
Okay, yeah. One of the other big things at the Ottawa Library site is they host online presentations by the OPCUG. And the next one is soft, free software, really free, on Monday, March 1st at 4 p.m. And that's hosted by our very own Alan German. Another site very similar to BookBub is the fussylibrarian.com. And they're similar to BookBub. You can get their daily email, or you can go direct to the site for free and bargain ebooks. It's not nearly as extensive as BookBub, but it's another good resource. Okay. Now, I went looking for good sites to download free ebooks at, and there must be like 50 different lists of places to download free ebooks, and some of the lists are the best 5 sites, the best 10 sites, the best 12 sites, the best 158 sites. And just doing a quick scan, this particular site here seemed to be fairly comprehensive. Pretty much any one of these websites, the very first thing they list is the Gutenberg Project, which is a great place to go for out of copyright books, because they have a very, very extensive library. So it's a great place to go. And if you're into ebook reading, Calibre, it's a free, it's pretty powerful, and it's an easy to use ebook manager. You can manage your ebook collection. They have versions that are compatible with Windows, Apple, Linux, Android, and iOS. They have a really good ebook viewer, one of the best around. Other services they have are downloading news and magazines from the web, sharing and backing up your library with friends and everything. You can edit some of the books in your collection if you want to make notes and whatever. You can convert between ebook formats, and you can link your Calibre library with your Amazon Kindle or other libraries. Now, I basically use Calibre to manage my collection of non-copy protected ebooks, which basically means the ebooks that I didn't get from Amazon Kindle or from Kobo. And so I haven't used some of the other features, but it's very powerful. I remember this was first brought to my attention many years ago by Mark Kaye, the club's membership guy. And it's great. It's free. Now, the function they have converting between ebook formats is somewhat limited. And in a future Q&A, I'll cover converting between EPUB formats, because there's some real gotchas there that you have to look out for. But for now, this is it for today.
And Peggy's asking, how do we read digital newspapers at the library?
That's a good question. I haven't used the library services very much.
Okay, well, I can tell you. You have to have a library card. You have to log on, and then if you go down to the e holdings, you'll find the newspapers and magazines, and you can search through for one that you want, and then you basically get like a full page spread, and you can zoom in and out and that kind of thing. It works quite well. And they have extensive holdings, different newspapers and so forth.
Yeah, we had a very good presentation on the library services, I guess, about a year and a half ago at one of our live meetings there. And I'm sure the deck for that is at the OPCUG website, so...
Yeah, the trouble is, Bob, they change their website all the time, and it's really hard to find stuff on it.
Yeah, I noted that.
Once you figure out how to do it, it's not so bad. Okay, thanks very much, Bob. I think now we're at the first prepared question, and this is from Glenn, and he was thinking of posting a Google review from a Google Maps link. And he wanted to know what about what were there any concerns or recommendations with respect to posting online reviews, especially when it comes to privacy and security, those kind of things? And one of the things he noted was that in the help file, essentially, for the ratings and reviews, it says that your content will appear publicly with your profile name and photo. And he's asking, does that mean that readers of any review he posts can access his Gmail address? And he didn't want that to happen because then it could be harvested by spammers and so forth. So he says, would changing about me as part of the Google account profile and change it from visible to anyone to visible only to you help to shield the Gmail address? But would that have a side effect in that the email address wouldn't be available to people he sends email messages to? So the answer to all of those questions basically is, if you look at a Google review, and this is a local Indian restaurant, some people might recognize this as having previously been called the Seacock on Rideau Street, kind of on the east edge of downtown, and now it's the guy retired and sold out, and it's taken over and has a new name. But it has these Google reviews. So if we have a look at the first, at the middle review there, you can basically see that the review, it does include the individual's name, Nicole Servage, and it also includes her profile photo. And then if you click on the actual review panel, you get to see her review, and it's basically just, you know, text describing what she thought about the restaurant. So if you look at the Google Maps help file, it tells you what others will see, and it says they will see the name on your About Me page, or the name on your Google profile. But it doesn't say anything about the photo, and yet clearly you get the name and the photo as part of the review. If you go to the Google account help file, then the first thing it tells you is that your name and profile photo will always be shown. Whenever you share content with other people, it will display your name and your photo from your profile. However, it also says that any other information, you can choose whether to keep it private or allow it to be visible. So you can certainly customize everything else in your Google account profile. So what are your options? Well, clearly you can just go ahead and post a review and include your name and your profile photograph. However, if you've got privacy concerns about both of those, then the best thing to do probably is don't post any reviews. If you want to be a bit more circumspect, I suspect one of the things you could do is delete your profile photograph, in which case Google will have like a default icon, and so that will just leave your name. So now the question is whether you're concerned about your name or not. So you could change that. You could use something like a German instead of Alan German. You could have a completely different name in a Gmail account, like Michael Mouse, for example. But then, you know, that doesn't really help people. If you put a review up with Mickey Mouse, I think people will not treat your review terribly seriously. You could also have an anonymous account like a Vedek, and everybody will recognize that Vedek is Slovakian for scientist. So that's a scientist. And you could just use an anonymous Google account. And that kind of brings me along to some general considerations about email addresses and what you should and shouldn't do or can and can't do. And I mean, clearly with Google, you could have all kinds of different accounts with different names and different email addresses. I kind of do the same thing because I've got my own domain name and I use a web hosting service to access that. So let's say for the purpose of the scammers, my domain is xyz.ca. I can have as many email addresses as I want on that domain. So typically I use mail and I reserve that for friends and family. If I'm dealing with businesses that I trust, like the bank and the library and that kind of thing, I'll use mailbox at my domain name. And then for everybody else, things I just register for one time, or websites I want to, I get access to, but I'm not sure that I necessarily trust them not to sell my email address to everybody in the world, then I use this Centaurus A email address. And you might ask, well, what's Centaurus A? Well, it's my little joke, my little physicist joke. Centaurus A is a black hole. So it's a super email address as a throwaway. And it has a couple of cousins. It has Cygnus X1 and it also has M1. And all of those are black holes. And you might think, well, I'd like to have a black hole email address at Gmail. And you'll find that you can't because they're all been taken. So for example, if I try and create an address for Michael Mouse, and I try to get Centaurus A at Gmail, it tells me that that username is taken and maybe you should try Michael Mouse 932. Probably Mickey Mouse isn't a terribly unique username. So clearly, if you're going to have a throwaway email address at Gmail, you have to be a little bit creative. And you can't have Alan the Linux guy because that one's already taken. But clearly you could have something like that means something to you. So for example, Michael Mouse has found that he could use mousetrapdenier@gmail.com. That's an available email address. So if you're concerned about posting online reviews, clearly, you know, you might want to use your real address, your real name, or something like it, but maybe you want to have a throwaway type email address that you don't really use for anything else. And Glenn followed up on this with me and said that one of the things he'd done was to modify his name in the Google account so that it wasn't obvious that somebody could guess his Gmail email address. I guess previously his address was very close to his name. So by changing his name a little bit, they couldn't guess his Gmail address. So there you are. That's what I have on posting reviews online.
We have a comment from Tom just saying that he's noticed the spam has been way down in the last few years. He deletes a few every day and forwards the viruses and phishes to a variety of governments.
Yeah, one other thing to note is that a lot of review sites will let you pick your on-screen name, and they promise to never divulge your email address to the general readership. So Amazon is that way and quite a few others. So you can choose what your on-screen reviewer name is going to be. And it can be something totally unrelated to your real name and your real email address.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so moving along, our next question will be discussed by that guy, the other guy, Chris.
I'm happy to be the other guy. We happen to have John on the call tonight, and so it actually is working again, mysteriously, on his computer. But I thought this was still a useful exercise to go through as just a general troubleshooting type scenario. You know, how is it that I would approach something like this to try and solve a particular problem? And I would certainly welcome anybody else who has other ideas after we go through my slides. If you have additional things that you would try on this particular problem, you know, to get things working again. So since a Windows 10 upgrade, which I think was actually a feature update, John, you can correct me if you want, rather than an upgrade from Windows 7 or Windows 8. And so all of a sudden file history was not working. And so my first thought, and if you go back one, So the first one is just, you know, make sure it's turned on. So if you go to update and security, backup, and then the file history. Is it actually turned on? I presume John has actually gone through that. But then clicking on the more options link that you see at that point, and now we'll go to the next slide. And so just looking at some of the things in here, you'll see the graphic box on the right-hand side is what you get when you go to the more options. And so looking at things like, you know, what does it say for last backup? You know, when was the last successful backup actually taken? Does the total space on the backup disk make sense? If you look at it, is it pointing to the right drive? You know, it'll have the drive letter. You know, so this is a 1 terabyte drive Z. Does that drive actually exist on my computer at this point in time? You know, I might want to go and check that. What happens on the backup, these folders, you'll have a big list down at the bottom. Does that make sense, the folders that are being backed up? Or are you looking to have a file that is being backed up that, well, you're not backing up that folder? You know, so you could add that particular folder in its place or something like that. What happens if you click on the backup now button that you see right there? It should go away, chug away for a few minutes, and then come back with the new last backup date and time on it. Does it give you an error message or something like that that might give you an idea about why it's not working? Or is it just, you know, go away and never come back with a new date and time, which tells me that, yeah, something is definitely not working right. Check the service. So the file history is actually run by a service that is running under Windows. And if you right-click on the Start button and go to Computer Management, then you can go to Services and Applications, Services, and then the one you're looking for is File History Service. So it should be running, and if it's not, you can just start it. But if it is says it's running, you could try stopping the service and then restart it. So right-click on the line for File History Service. It'll pop up with a menu. You say stop the service, and then it'll stop, and then right-click again and say start the service. Then go back and try that under the more options to do the backup now again. Does that all of a sudden fix the problem? Maybe it was just the service wasn't running properly or something like that. Another thing that you could do is try adding another folder in. And so go back into the more options. I would try adding some new folder that is not currently on the list, drop a file into that folder, and then see if that gets backed up. You know, I'm guessing that this is not going to work, but it's always worth trying. Just see if it's somehow confused about what folders are actually being backed up. Maybe adding a new folder, it'll recognize that as something new. And then we can say, oh, okay, it's working on some, but it's not working on others. Then the other thing you could do is go to the event logs and check for errors. So if you right-click on Start and with the menu that pops up, or you can hit WinX, we'll bring up the same menu, and you go to Event Viewer. And the place you want to navigate to is Application and Services Logs, Microsoft, Windows, File History Core, WHC is one of them, but that's not actually likely to be the issue. There seems to be very little that's under there. There is another one under Application and Services Logs, Microsoft, Windows, File History Engine, and then there's an entry called File History Backup Log. If you click on that, that does have a lot of activity that is going on whenever the service is generating events. And check for the error level error events. So there's informational ones and warnings, and then there's errors. There will almost certainly be some occasional errors that pop up, and I don't worry about occasional errors, but if you see it constantly, like every time that the file history backup is supposed to be running, you're seeing an error in there, then that's telling you that, yeah, for sure something is failing. But otherwise, you know, it probably isn't a cause for concern if you see an occasional error. If you do see constant errors, there are error codes in there. You could Google for it and see if somebody's got an idea about how to fix that particular problem. And then the other thing you can do is reinitialize file history completely. And there's really two things that you need to do on this. So the first thing is to stop the current configuration from running. So you go to settings, update and security, backup, more options, and down at the bottom you'll see an option to stop using drive. You click on that and it will stop trying to back up to that particular backup drive. Then what I would do is go and rename the folder on that backup drive that is called file history. It's always named that, and it's always at the root of that backup drive. Rename it. Don't delete it, because any files that you happen to have backed up are still there and still accessible. You can go in manually, and you can actually access all of those backed up files. You can delete it if you want, but it's just that there may be files in there that are backups that you're actually interested in. Then what you have to do is go to /users/your username, app data, which is a hidden folder. So you have to, in Windows configuration, in file manager, if you go on the view tab, you can have it show hidden files. So you go under app data, local, Microsoft, Windows, file history, and there'll be two folders underneath there, one called data and one called configuration. And I typically like to just rename them, so that I can always get back to the current state of affairs if I wanted to. You could also just delete them, quite frankly. But if you rename them, it gives you a means of getting back. And then, so with those renamed, I'll then go back into file history and set up the drive again. So just go through the same way you did it the first time, point to your backup drive, set the folders that you want to back up, set your times when you want to back up, things like that. And that, I think, is about all of the troubleshooting things that I could think of dealing with file history. And it's just sort of a methodical thing of going through one step after the other, looking at, logical things that could possibly be that I know of that could stop file history from working properly. Is there anybody else out there who has had experience with file history breaking on them and what they did to get it working again, if they ever got it working again?
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I've noticed in Windows 10 especially, if things start to not work quite right, inevitably if I go to the shutdown and sign out menu, there's an update and shutdown or update and restart thing, which you don't normally get. And sure enough, if you go through that, sometimes it'll fix the problem. Other times, once you've done that and you've done a new update, if things don't seem to be working properly, inevitably Microsoft does a little bit of an oopsie, and within a few days they'll sort of fix that. As you mentioned, with this broken file history, the problem seemed to resolve itself after a few days, and that's probably one of these Microsoft oopsie type of things.
Yeah, it could well be that that's the case, that it was just one of the regular monthly updates that happened to fix it. Microsoft definitely is known to just silently fix things in the background without admitting to the fact that there ever was a problem. So I guess that's another troubleshooting technique as well, is just wait for the next monthly update from Microsoft and see if that fixes the problem. Because I've had that happen to me on occasion, where I had, problems, and it was month after month after month that I was trying all kinds of things. And then mysteriously, right after a monthly update, things started working normally again. So definitely that's a good technique. You might have to wait a month for it, but it may well fix your problem.
It doesn't even have to be a monthly update, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think Microsoft does micro updates in the background without you even being aware of it.
They can and do. They usually reserve those to circumstances that are pretty dire. So something is, fundamentally broken for lots and lots and lots of people, or it's a security issue that is something circulating in the wild that they need to push out a fix for rapidly. They'll definitely do those at off times. But other than that, if it's random things that are not likely to be affecting a lot of people, they usually will save them for Patch Tuesday on the second Tuesday of the month. But they can definitely do out-of-band updates, and they do. So it's possible anytime.
Tom Prache here. There are some updates currently for .NET, by the way, that you can download. I don't think they're automatic. Regarding file history, what I've done is when things seem to get screwed up, I just wipe my history disk, reformat it, and start up file history again. Now, that, of course, means that you'd lose any other history that you had on there. But I just have an old 1 terabyte disk that I'm using for my file history.
Yeah, if you run into that, what I would do a little less drastic than that is just rename the file history folder on that drive, and it should get recreated the next time file history actually runs. You may need to stop the service before you can actually do the rename. I'm not sure. But that would actually preserve your existing file history. All the files are there. You can go in and you can see them. They have the original file name, and appended to that is the date and time that the actual backup occurred for that particular file, and so you can actually browse through and you can do things manually to get things back. So I would tend to do that, a little bit less of a hammer approach a sledgehammer approach than reformatting the entire drive. But file history, I take it that quite a few people do have occasional problems with it. Knock on wood, I've not had any issues with file history myself, but it's wonderful when it works, that's for sure.
Lawrence is just commenting that it's not only Microsoft that have mysterious fixes. Dell's driver update all of a sudden fixed a slow network speed problem on a laptop after several months of fruitless investigation.
Yeah.
And shaking his head there. Okay, thanks, Chris. It's very good information. Okay, our next question is to do with editing PDF files. And this is from Michelle. And she says that the Adobe, the Acrobat license is quite expensive. And she's looking for a free and safe way to edit PDF files, mostly markup and comment when working on a document with somebody else, and do we have any suggestions? So this is a question I posted on the members only forum, and one of the replies came back from Micheline, who does edit PDF files, and she notes that she uses PDF Exchange Viewer, and she uses that to add the source URL in text, in the text box, to the top of the PDF that she stores. So she always has a reference back to the source of the document. And so here's the link for PDF Exchange Viewer. It's a free viewer, but it does have some annotation capabilities. And however, I would note that it hasn't been updated since 2018 because Tracker Software, the developer, has moved on and is now producing a different product called PDF Exchange Editor, and I haven't tried that one, so I don't know what the difference is, but one of those two is certainly a possibility for editing PDF files.
Well, one of the things that's different, I believe, about PDF Exchange Editor, I was on their site today, and it doesn't look like they have a free version.
Oh, I thought I looked and they did.
Oh, I could be wrong then. Of course, most of these vendors that do have free versions, they don't want you to find the free versions.
Oh, they hide it. Yeah, they hide it. Yeah. You try and find PDF Exchange Viewer on their website if you don't know where it is.
Oh, that's okay.
I gave you the full URL. Yeah, that's certainly a problem, Chris. Interestingly enough, one of the Linux kind of digest sites that I look at basically on a daily version. Just today, I had a link to an editor a method for editing PDF files in Linux. And the solution they're suggesting was to use LibreOffice Draw. And the nice thing about LibreOffice Draw is that there's a Windows version in addition to Linux. So this is a solution that's not just available to Linux users. And anybody who's used LibreOffice, you're probably familiar with the Writer module, which is Word, the Calc module, which is Excel, the Impress module, which is like PowerPoint. This one over here is Base, which is like Microsoft Accent database part. And this one right here is a module which is unique to LibreOffice. It's not reflected in Microsoft Office. They have a completely separate Draw module. So I fired it up in under Windows, and I pulled up the latest issue of the newsletter, and I found some white space right here, and so I annotated it by adding a right arrow and a yellow text box, and I added some text here to tell my colleague that I'm working on this document with that they could add some text at this point in the document. So this is just using the LibreOffice package, using the Draw module. You basically open the PDF file in Draw, you annotate the pages using the drawing tools, and then you call up the Export to PDF menu and save the file. And when you load that file into, this is PDF Exchange Viewer, just being used as a viewer, you can see that the file that I saved has the annotation right on the first page there. So it's somewhat limited in terms of the drawing tools that it has available. Now, I'm not an expert on Draw, so it probably has quite a lot of different tools that you could use.
Alan, I take it you can't actually edit the text of the existing PDF, though, eh?
That I don't know. I doubt it, because it's a drawing package. So
yeah, right.
Yeah, so okay. I'm sure you can't.
Okay.
Yeah, so maybe that wouldn't work if you wanted to do that. If you wanted to play around with the text, you'd need a true PDF editor program, I guess. But for annotation, works fine.
Maybe it would be better if they used a Google Docs or perhaps a Microsoft, I'm not familiar with that, as a document for sharing rather than using a PDF, which is meant for presentation.
I don't know what the application is, Tom, so I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
Anyway, those are a couple of options for at least annotating PDFs.
There are some comments in the chat about some Adobe license used to come with some scanners. Maybe it still does. Now, one comment I'll have on that is that the Adobe Acrobat reader or editor, Adobe Acrobat is one of the buggiest pieces of software on the face of the earth. And every year they will fix dozens of security problems with their program. It is also on the vast majority of computers out there, so the bad guys are looking for vulnerabilities. They're looking for computers that are not getting updated to fix those particular bugs. So I highly recommend that people remove Adobe Reader and, if they can, Adobe Acrobat, if they are using an editor, from their computer, and go with an alternative package that is less likely to cause you security headaches.
Yeah, so Tom was suggesting that Adobe with the license would come free with the scanner.
Yeah.
Lawrence isn't sure about that. And it sounds unlikely to me, but who knows?
And
it's a very expensive scanner.
Stefan asks, can you delete reorder pages with LibreOffice Draw? And that would be a no. Would strictly be a matter of, as Alan says, annotating existing pages as they exist. And Natalie comments, Foxit works well for PDF. I've used Foxit Reader for many, many years as a replacement for Adobe Reader for sure. And they have an editor package too. It's not free, but they do have a package that will do full edits. You can actually bring up a PDF file in Microsoft Word and edit it. You know, exactly how the page gets rendered is usually not exactly the same, but it's pretty close. And Tom says he used Sumatra PDF for reading PDF files as well, and that's free. So, yeah, that's definitely another option.
Yeah, and that PDF Exchange viewer works really well for reading PDFs too.
Yeah.
If you want to delete and reorder pages of a PDF file, a really good program to do that, I forget the name right now, I think it's PDF Sam. It has a lot of functionality when it comes to playing around with pages. There's a review of it on the OPCUG website. So if I haven't got the name right, then it's certainly listed there. Okay, moving along. A question from Iqbal. He has a 7-year-old desktop computer. Should he look for a new one, or can he prolong the life of this old desktop? And if so, how would he do it? And of course, he'd favor the most economical solution. And we've discussed this previously, so I just mentioned, it's the usual answer, right? It all depends. How old's the laptop? How efficient is it? What don't you like about it right now? If it's using Windows 7, then, and it won't update to Windows 10, you probably shouldn't be using it to access the internet, because you're just leaving yourself open to all kinds of exploits. So things like that are a concern or an issue that you should be considering. One of the things that usually dramatically boosts performance is to swap out the hard drive for a solid state drive. And solid states are big and cheap these days, typically. And they really do increase boot time. They decrease boot times considerably. And they also decrease the time to load files and applications. So you can see a distinctive speed increase just by swapping out the SSD. And the neat thing about that is, if it really doesn't work, you just rip the SSD out of the desktop, throw the desktop away, buy a new desktop, and then use the SSD in that, or put in an external drive and make it into an external SSD. The other thing you can do is, if you're short on memory, if memory is a bottleneck, because it's an older desktop, you can probably pick up the appropriate chips relatively cheap on something like Kijiji or Amazon or whatever, and just load it up with memory. And again, a few dollars spent will tell you whether that's going to work or not. And then if it's really a problem that your operating system is really slow, some operating systems can be, you could always switch from that one and just use Linux, because it's much quicker. Anyway, those are my thoughts, and nobody else is kicking in or anything else, so there we go. Now, the next thing I have here is a share. This is from Stuart, and he's thinking about...
One moment before you completely leave this. There is a compromise between the SSD and a hard disk, and that's what's known as a hybrid disk, which has usually 32 gigabytes of flash memory attached to it. I think Seagate is the most prominent, perhaps the only seller of this, and their Momentus drives do that. And so it's a compromise between having a large storage pile and having fast access to the stuff you most recently accessed.
Yeah, my thought there, Tom, that's true, but because this is a desktop, it's probably got a spare drive bay, so you could put the SSD in and use that as the main drive and use the existing hard drive as secondary storage or backup or both or whatever. So you could get the best of both worlds with a simple SSD.
Natalie has a question in the chat. Would the same advice apply to an older laptop? My 5-year-old Lenovo hardware scan just flagged my hard disk drive as problematic. And on laptops, the three things that you could actually look to doing upgrades or replacements on laptops is usually the hard drive, memory, and the operating system. So certainly all of those things that Alan talked about would actually be doable on a laptop as well. Tom happens to mention I'd replace the hard disk drive with solid state drive ASAP. Usually when hard drives start throwing errors, they rarely get better.
Yeah, I make a disk image like right now.
Yeah.
The other good thing about laptops is it's usually pretty easy to, especially on a five-year-old laptop, it's probably pretty easy to replace the hard drive. Typically, yeah. A couple of screws, you take off a panel, the drive's right there, you unplug a cable, and it's a replacement SSD, the same cable goes in, you're passing the panel back in again, and off you go. It works. It's really easy to do.
And a lot of SSDs will also come with software as well, specifically designed to move your data and everything, the operating system and so forth, off the hard disk drive onto the solid state, and then you swap that in, and you're up and running. And they'll include instructions on step-by-step-by-step on how to go about doing that, and it's usually really, really simple to do.
Yeah, I've replaced the mechanical hard drive on two laptops with a solid state drive, and it goes fairly cleanly. And you can take a mechanical hard drive, and at a place like Canada Computers or at Amazon, you can get
enclosure.
External USB.
Yeah, enclosure. You can take the old hard drive, put it in it, plug it into a USB port, and thereby transfer all your data and other stuff over once you get the solid state drive up and running.
Okay.
All right, so moving on, the share from Stuart. He's talking about these companies where you send a sample and they give you a DNA analysis. And he's suggesting that some of these companies, the results are not entirely clear. And he says he hasn't done this and he doesn't plan on doing it, but it seems to be a popular thing to do. And he found a website that offers secondary analysis, so they will help you understand what the first website actually told you. So if that's a problem for you, then that is a possible solution, I guess.
I put my DNA into 23andMe, I don't know, about 6-7 years ago, a year or two after they first started. My son gave me a gift package. I'm in there as not under my real name, but originally when they did it, they had some health stuff that they did. I can probably share that on the thing, but basically sensitivities to drugs and some other stuff like that that might be useful to people. They've stopped doing it in the U.S. because it's illegal under the I guess the FDA, the whatever the medical government body is. But they may still do it for Canadians. I don't know, but that can be useful. It seems like the main use for these DNA websites is mainly looking at your history of what places you come from, where your DNA comes from, whether it's Sweden or South Africa or wherever else. But it is possible to get medical stuff out of them as well. And 23andMe probably has the best thing. If you put stuff into a random website, this was how I think they found a serial killer in California.
Yeah, the Golden State Killer.
Yeah. Not because he puts his DNA in, but because some relatives did.
Yeah.
Into a wide open site where you can find relatives and so on. So the purpose of DNA is defining relatives, which is useful, I suppose. But the main use that I see a value for is actually looking at possible medical aspects of it, whether it's susceptibility to some disease or cancer or something or something else. But you probably need a real geneticist to actually tell you for certain what things mean.
It's sort of timely because last Sunday evening's 60 Minutes did a segment on the privacy issues with using sites like 23andMe or Ancestry.com to analyze your DNA. because where that information goes, you really have no control over. And their privacy statements are sort of wishy-washy and don't really cover it. So you might want to go to the 60 Minutes website and have a look at that story and get a little bit of an eye-opener.
Well, Tom's going to be okay because the police can't find him. He didn't use his real name, so it's fine. Okay, this is a question from me, actually from a friend of mine. I got one of these "I need little help, write me back" type messages from a friend who uses Hotmail. And in Thunderbird, you can actually check all the message headers. So I looked in there because last time I saw a message like this, it was clear that the hacker had put reply to somebody else. But in this case, the headers all look correct. So I was kind of confused how this guy was going to get his information. And then my friend tells me that, well, she could send messages, but she couldn't get any replies and she wasn't receiving any other messages on this Hotmail account. So I asked an email guru, how does this scam work? And what else should my friend be cautious about? And the guru is now going to tell us.
As soon as I see that somebody can send from an email account, but they can't receive email there, I'm immediately suspicious that if they did get hacked, that the hacker actually set up an automatic forwarding on their email account. So you can go that on a Gmail or the Hotmail is actually an Outlook.com address, and you can definitely set up automatic forwarding, and you can set it so that it deletes the incoming mail after it does forwarding. So the email is actually coming into the mailbox, but it's immediately getting sent off to the attacker, and then the original is actually getting deleted. So why is this a really bad thing? Well, if you use that email address as a recovery email address, the attacker could be going onto every site that they think you might be on and trying to do a password reset. And then the email gets sent to that email address on click here to reset your password. And that ends up going to the attacker. The attacker can then go and reset the password on your other account somewhere and lock you out and do other nefarious things. So another thing is that if you get bank transfers, you know, you get the email transfer come into your mailbox and you have to click on that to actually accept the money, and the attacker will actually get that and they can make off with the money. A side note on this, a good thing to do I found with email transfers is you can actually go on and set it so that you don't get the email. It will just automatically transfer it into your bank if any money is sent to a specific email address. There's a couple emails back and forth that have to go on to make sure that you do control that email address and so forth. But after that, any money that gets transferred to you as an e-transfer will just automatically go into your bank account. So that's kind of nice. And did we have any more on this?
No.
No. Okay.
The only other thing I've got is that my friend moved from Hotmail to Gmail. So now we have to wait till somebody hacks the Gmail account again.
Yeah. So the big thing on this too is that if you were using it as recovery address for any other services, make sure you go on those other services, if you can get onto them, that they haven't already been compromised, change the passwords on them, and change the recovery email address to some other email address, things like that. So you may want to look into those other linked services that you use.
You can also add second factor authentication.
Yeah. Two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication is always a very good thing to do as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you can put an authenticator on your phone that gives you a time-sensitive number that will allow you to get in. You can also get fairly cheaply some little USB keys that have a button on them that you press that Amazon and other Google and other sites can actually use to authenticate you as a second factor.
Yeah, the YubiKey is a very common one on that.
Chris, Peggy's asking if there's a way to avoid the hacker in the first place.
Well, the fact that they got onto this person's email address tells me that there are other things that could have been done. Certainly, as Tom mentioned, two-factor authentication on it would have avoided this compromise on that Hotmail account. Having a very strong password on it is very important. Not reusing passwords. And in actual fact, at the March meeting of the Ottawa PC User Group, the main meeting, I will be talking for probably close to 2 hours on, or at least an hour and a half, on password safety and password keepers and things like that.
As a note, not long before Christmas, I got an email from an old friend of mine asking how I was doing and where was I these days and everything else. And not thinking much of it, I responded, and then he got an email back asking if he wanted to be a surprise, so could I get some gift cards and all that for his daughter, and email him the information. And that raised an automatic red flag with me. So I got a hold of him through other means and whatever, because he wasn't that close an old friend to ask something like that. And it turned out his email account had been hacked into, and everybody on his contact list was getting these stupid emails. So,
Tom put in the chat window a link to Amazon with a security key. And also Wendy mentioned that she used VIP access by Symantec. It's free and works on Android and iOS devices for the second factor. So you could check into any of those if people are interested.
Natalie says she dumped Hotmail and Yahoo because of frequent hacks. Is Gmail fairly secure? I don't hear people having their Gmail account hacked.
I don't think I have heard of it. I don't know.
Well, I'm pretty sure it's happened. There have been people who have downloaded other stuff, especially pictures from Google accounts. So if you can guess the password, and some celebrities are unimaginative, shall we say. So I think that two-factor authentication is a good thing to do. I have a couple of security keys. You can also get them with Bluetooth, which I don't use. I just have the plain ones, which cost about $10 each. And by the way, you should always get two of them so that you have a backup if things go very wrong.
Natalie says she's never had a problem with Gmail and she has 5 accounts. And Wendy says the same thing.
Yeah, Tom, can you email your security keys to me for a backup here?
Okay, moving on.
I'll do my best.
Moving on. We're basically thinking, how might we get a wider audience for Q&A? They've been pretty successful, pretty popular anyway, over the last few months. And I say we've even answered to ask a few of the questions that people have asked. But what we're thinking is, would future Q&As benefit other people, and in particular other groups? And the reason that this came up was I was listening to a radio show, and they were talking about reestablishing in-house programs for seniors and residences, basically, now that they've got vaccination and they can get together again, that kind of thing. And I was wondering whether, you know, some people like that who were interested in computers would be interested or benefit from joining our online sessions. The question is, though, how do you promote our sessions to people who aren't members of the club? So if anybody has any bright ideas in terms of who might benefit and how we might approach those people, please let us know. And with that, it's time to say, are there any other questions, comments, or anything you'd like to share?
Well, with regard to seniors, as I am one, and as I look around at all the white hair, I think there are other seniors on currently. But there are other, there are different seniors groups that you might use to promote OPCUG. There are a whole variety of senior centers, and I'm sure that they would be willing to do something, especially if it were a little special to them, but just ordinarily to do an invite, especially if there were some special topic, although I guess the library things are probably more special for that kind of thing.
And Natalie's suggesting the Good Companions and the Council on Aging, various community centers. Bill's saying that since the sessions are accessible, why not share them as a blog? Well, we kind of share them as a website, so they are available on the web.
Anyhow, in particular, I guess if people have contact information in particular, a title of a place is one thing and useful for sure, but also if anybody has any contact info within any of those organizations, please send it on. So Natalie said she'll send contact. So that would be wonderful. Thank you.
And they don't have to be seniors organizations. I mean, as Tom said, there's a lot of seniors in this group, but maybe we could help other people too.
Yeah.
Okay. We're about 5 minutes over the hour, so if there aren't any other questions, we can start to wrap up, I guess.
I think so.
So Bob has very kindly mentioned the next Tech Cafe session that we're going to do for the library, which will be March the 1st. And it's going to be me talking about various free software packages. Our next regular meeting is next week, February the 10th, and we've got Dee Reimer back from Victoria Pymakers talking about microcontrollers and IoT, the Internet of Things. And of course, next week, therefore, will also be our next Q&A. So if you have any questions, topics, or can answer any of the questions that Chris pushes out on the announcement list, send the information along to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And with that, I thank everyone for attending. I hope you found it interesting. And we'll see you next week, after the regular meeting.
Thanks very much for attending, folks.
Okay, thanks, everybody. Great session.